This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
So some will, and I think sometimes in a cynical way, say, well, why don't you just let nature take its course? You know, these animals are dying on the beach. There's probably some natural reason. Why do you do this work in the first place? And one of the reasons for me and for the 1,200 people who are part of this organization is it's the right thing to do. It's the humane thing to do. We can alleviate suffering, so we ought to. But this science that we're able to support and to advance is helping us understand what's going on with the health of the oceans.
If you've ever seen a seal bobbing its head in the ocean, you might have been too busy admiring its natural beauty to think about the obstacles that this graceful creature had to overcome to reach adulthood. Our guest today on Sea Change Radio is Jeff Bohm, a veterinarian and the executive director of the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito, California. When he sees that seal, he sees a potential patient. Ocean trash, toxic algae blooms, domoic acid, and overfishing are just a few of the health threats that human activity is inflicting on marine life. We discuss these adversities and others facing seals, sea lions, and marine mammals in general, and learn about the work that Dr. Bohm and his team do to try to mitigate the perils of living in an increasingly dangerous ocean habitat. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Jeff Bohm. He's a veterinarian and the executive director of the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito, California. Jeff, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
First, for our listeners around the country, why don't you talk about some of the good work that you and your colleagues do at the Marine Mammal Center?
Yeah, happy to do so. We are a nonprofit teaching hospital. We just happen to focus on marine mammals. We cover 600 miles of the California coastline as the range within which we'll rescue these animals. Our primary focus is getting them in, getting them well, getting them back out in the ocean. But each patient that comes our way is an opportunity to advance a really robust scientific research agenda. And some of the things that we're finding out are pretty stunning about the waters off this coast, certainly. And finally, we educate. We talk to people about the work that we do and feel that if we can contribute to moving people towards a better understanding of their own role as good stewards of the ocean, that's a huge contribution we can make as well.
So why don't you give us an idea of the type of animals you treat? It's mostly seals and sea lions, correct?
Right. Those are all animals that are part of a group we call pinnipeds, and this is your seals and sea lions. We do respond to any marine mammal that comes up on our beaches, but more than 95% of the animals that come into our care are, in fact, California sea lions, harbor seals, elephant seals.
And you don't have the physical plant to be able to bring in a whale and heal that whale in your facility, correct?
Correct.
This would have to
correct.
Be kind of an on-site deal.
Yeah, so even some of the larger seals and sea lions, elephant seals are quite large, and we joke that we make a house call if that's the case, and we'll go out on the beaches sometimes, remotely sedate the animals, get close to them to remove a packing strap or to otherwise intervene. But you're right, very large animals, we need to go to them.
Are you the go-to hospital for Ano Nuevo down near Pescadero, north of Santa Cruz, which is one of the famous nesting grounds for elephant seals? Are you the kind of de facto hospital for this site?
We are. And so really any beach along 600 miles of coastline from Mendocino County on the far north down to San Luis Obispo County, with San Francisco being in the middle, any shoreline that an animal comes up on, we are the folks who will go there. And that spans national parks, state parks, county parks, et cetera. Ano Nuevo is this exceptional place in that it is it offers a refuge for elephant seals and others that are out on that island.
And give us a little history on the Marine Mammal Center. Before we started speaking, you said that you actually worked as a volunteer as a kid, and now you're the executive director. So it's been around for a little while.
It has. It has. We are in our 40th year in 2015, and the transition over those 40 years has been nothing short of remarkable. Started with volunteers who wanted to do the right thing by the animals that they were seeing coming up on the coast, and has grown now to an organization of international renown. We've treated more than 20,000 animals during those 40 years, and we were started by volunteers, and volunteers are still the driving force of our work. We have more than 1,200 volunteers who help us achieve the goals of the organization.
So what years were you volunteering?
Yeah, so I grew up not far from the organization, wanted to be a veterinarian from the time I was just a youngster, and found my way out to volunteer in 1980 at the Marine Mammal Center.
So 35 years since you've been interacting with these mammals on a daily basis. Maybe you can give us a kind of a quick time lapse snapshot of how climate change and encroaching habitat has affected the patients that you treat at the center.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. 40 years ago, the organization was responding to those animals that came up on the beach, just as we are today. But when you think about the things that are impacting them now and the discussions that we're having because of what we are privileged to see by virtue of what the patients bring to us with ailments and the challenges they face, it's nothing short of stunning. I think the work of the Marine Mammal Center has never been more relevant than it is today. This year, as a case in point, we've seen more than 1,700 patients in this year alone. That in the context of having seen 20,000 in 40 years. Significant numbers of animals are coming in. And if you were to look from a percentage basis at what causes the animals to be in harm's way or to be ill, malnutrition is at the top of the list. And this year and last, warm waters off the California coast are really kind of precluding nursing females from getting the forage fish that they would need to raise their pups well.
Can you explain how that works exactly?
Sure. Off the Southern California coast, and this has been in place for a couple of years now, a warm water blob is what it's referred to in the media, has been in place. And if you're a California sea lion, for instance, you're giving birth to your pups on the Channel Islands off of the Southern California coast, and you're nursing those pups for the better part of a year, some 10, 11 months. So you're going off on these foraging expeditions to get your own nutrition. You're likely pregnant at that same time with the next pup. So your nutritional needs, your caloric needs are high. The warm water is precluding the colder, nutrient-rich waters, which are part of this amazing upwelling on the California coast. The warm waters are keeping those waters at bay. And so these females are traveling greater and greater distances to get the food that they need. They're coming back poorly nourished themselves, unable to care for their pups, sometimes aborting and losing the pup that they're carrying. And at a point, these pups are effectively orphaned, and they have left those rookeries, and this past year came up on California coast beaches to the tune of some 3,000 animals that were prematurely without their moms in really poor body condition. The primary problem being malnutrition, sometimes secondary problems like parasitism and infections as well. But this is a manifestation of things that are really changing in our ocean environment, and things that we wouldn't be talking about were it not for the fact that we were looking at each individual animal that comes into our care and trying to think about what the bigger picture is, what these animals are telling us, what window they give us into ocean health.
So you're treating more marine mammals than ever before, but do you also have an idea of their population and whether seals and sea lions are becoming more endangered, or are you just treating more of them that are ill?
We do have a good sense of the population numbers off of our coast. Certainly with the three primary species that we see, and these are California sea lions, Pacific harbor seals, and northern elephant seals. With California sea lions, the numbers are up upwards of 270,000, approaching 300,000 individuals. The other two species, about 40 or 50,000 animals.
This is just Northern California, or is this worldwide?
This is just California. And for some of these, that is their
like a Pacific Harbor seal. Extent. This is their region.
Yeah, yeah. So are these animals that I'm mentioning endangered? No. Is this a significant situation? Well, sure. It's been a few years now where your class of pups, if you will, it has been hit hard, and there have been losses. As biologists who go out and look at these animals are thinking about what this means for the population. They're thinking about where that cohort will be some 3 to 5 years from now when they're of reproductive age. Might this signal some population effects? Perhaps. What's important for us, and something that we bear in mind, is whether it's an insight into the state of forage fish and the lack of them along our coastlines, or another instance, whether it's an insight into a harmful algal bloom and how that's impacting the animals, or an incidence of cancer that we see in California sea lions. These are all things that for us are not only important for the care of each and every patient that we see, but are helping us through the peer-reviewed publications that we get out, offer insights and offer avenues of research to some of our colleagues as well.
Over the years you swam the ocean, following feelings of your own. Now you are washed up on the shoreline. I can see your body.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the executive director of the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito, California, Jeff Bohm. So, Jeff, give us an idea of the breakdown of quote-unquote natural causes of death and illness you see in your patients versus man-made. What percentage would you say is of your job is caused by us being around?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. There's a couple of ways I'd want to frame this. One, we do track because we are part of a national marine mammal stranding network, and we work under the authorization of NOAA Fisheries. And data is amassed by us and our colleagues and centralized in that way. And one of the things that they look for are what the anthropogenic cases are, what the numbers are. And it's roughly 8 to 10% of the animals that come in that fall into that category. And these are animals that are impacted by ingestion of fishing hooks or entanglement in marine debris or, sadly and disturbingly, gunshot victims.
Well, couldn't even cancer be considered a man-made?
Well, there you go.
Thing, right?
So
from chemicals, right?
So while not classified that way for those purposes, I'm hard pressed, Alex, to think of any of the cases that come in that don't in some way have our fingerprints on
really?
Them. And that to put that in context, you reference cancer. Roughly 1 in 5 of the adult sea lions that come into our care. So bear in mind, these are animals that are sick for some reason, right? If they die in our care, we find have cancer, and it's the same kind of cancer. It's a urogenital carcinoma that these animals have, both the males and the females. They also in their blubber are carrying around chemicals that are sometimes legacy chemicals, DDT and the likes that have persisted in the ocean environment.
For generations, really.
For generations, right. Right. As well as contemporary things like flame retardants and others. It looks like there is a heritable aspect to this as well as a viral component as well, but it has oncologists at local universities looking over our shoulders at this cancer cluster, if you will, and trying to assess what it means, not just for wildlife health, but for human health as well. So yeah, absolutely, you can draw a connection between that situation and human influence. If you look at a toxicity that we see, and this is something that's been in the press here on the West Coast for some time this fall, in that there is a toxin that's produced by algae. The toxin is called domoic acid, and it happens to be a mimic of a naturally occurring neurotransmitter. In California sea lions, when it's ingested, it causes seizures. That's if it's an acute situation. If it's chronically ingested, it actually causes death of neural tissue and other challenges to the animal as well. Well, this is a naturally occurring toxin, right? It's produced by algae, but those algal blooms are influenced by
temperature
effluent,
change.
Temperature change, nutrients in effluent coming out of estuaries and out of rivers and streams, all of which are impacted by us. So there again, you have what on the surface sounds like a naturally occurring problem, but clearly is something that is influenced by us. So some will, and I think sometimes in a cynical way, say, well, why don't you just let nature take its course? You know, these animals are dying on the beach. There's probably some natural reason. Why do you do this work in the first place? And one of the reasons for me and for the 1,200 people who are part of this organization is it's the right thing to do. It's the humane thing to do. We can alleviate suffering, so we ought to. But this science that we're able to support and to advance is helping us understand what's going on with the health of the oceans. And it's not only something, as we're discussing this, has kind of our signature on it. It's something that is going to influence human health as well.
I wanted to jump in, actually, since you mentioned domoic acid. Outside of Arctic region and indigenous people who consume and hunt seals, in the continental United States, we generally don't eat seals. But what we do eat is Dungeness crab. And I just saw that there's a Dungeness crab ban instituted in Northern California because of domoic acid. How does that affect the populations you treat? And give us a little bit more behind the crab ban, if you will.
Sure. It's been interesting to us because we've been talking about domoic acid for a couple of decades now, as we've seen the manifestations of it in the California sea lions that we treat. And this summer was no exception in that we saw a significant number of patients coming in intoxicated, if you will, impacted by this toxin.
Yeah, I saw a video of them. They look kind of drunk and then they die pretty quickly.
Yeah,
it's horrifying.
It is. And for people on the beach, if they don't know what's going on, to see an animal that's a few hundred pounds in a seizure is a pretty pretty terrifying thing. What happened this year, though, was the preponderance of the algal bloom, if you will, and its size and scope and persistence meant that the toxin was there in over a greater region and for a longer period of time, and eventually became part of the substrate, part of the detritus at the bottom, where, in fact, these crabs are, which meant that from a public health point of view, there was a risk to humans. So it hit the media in a way far greater because of the human interest side of it and because of the preference so many people have, especially around the Thanksgiving holiday for eating Dungeness crab, that domoic acid stole the headlines, not because of sea lions, but because of the crabs.
Are you underfunded, not your organization, but the animal care industry as a whole for wild animals? Do you think that we need to put more resources towards treating the animals that we've impacted in addition to a concurrent effort to try to mitigate pollution and other damage that we wreak upon these mammals.
The resource needs are significant for the work that we do. And when you think about, as a nonprofit organization, we're hugely grateful for the contributions that we receive from individuals, from corporations, from foundations. But when you look at kind of the philanthropic pie and you look at church groups and academic affiliations as the two biggest areas where individuals tend to give their support, we are a small part of that small sliver of that pie that goes to the environment. And my gosh, when I think about these next 40 years, the significance of the work of organizations like ours is only going to be greater. And having the resources, the financial resources to be the first responders that we are for these incredible animals is one thing. Having the additional resources to be able to continue to investigate scientifically what is going on and what the implications of that are is huge. And then finally, to be able to, in a more aggressive and widespread way, get people involved, get them to care, get them to understand, and get them to act as better global stewards is a big part of what our resources are going towards. And yes, we can always use more.
I never learned why meteors were falling. I only farmed in schools that were so warm and tall. If anyone
Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Jeff Bohm. He's the executive director of the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito. So, Jeff, what has your research and tracking of these animals told us about rising sea levels? Not just sea level rise, but sea temperature rise. Are these animals going farther and farther up north, or do they not have to swim as far for food now?
Of interest to all of us at the Marine Mammal Center, especially in light of this persistent warm water mass off of the California coast, is the fact that some scientists are seeing a link between that and climate change, in that the same thing that's contributed to this blob is connected to the California drought that has been in persistence now for 4 years. But the lack of the storms that typically originate up in the Arctic is what has kind of allowed those warm waters to persist, where usually they'd be pushed south and west, allowing the deep, cool water to come up. That lack of those storm systems, some scientists are linking to a decrease in Arctic ice. That would be where these storm systems would originate.
You said that there were 270,000 California sea lions with other facilities along the California coast and Pacific Northwest and Mexico. What percentage would you guess we're able to help ailing animals? Are there, you said you processed 1,700. What kind of a dent are we making in helping these animals in need?
Right. So if you look at the entire coast of California this past year, the number of animals I believe that came in was somewhere around 3,500. And if you just round the entire population up to 300,000, that's roughly 1% of those animals that are coming in. Those are animals that come up on shore that someone happens to see that there is the wherewithal to mount a rescue. So it's clearly not all of them. Still a significant number, and by virtue of the size of that number, some 3,500 animals, some power in what the insights are that are available to us when we're looking at the health of that population. You couple the work that we do with the work that some of our colleagues do who are part of NOAA Fisheries, so federal employees who are marine mammal biologists, who go out and study the population year in, year out on the Channel Islands, and you start to get not just a sense of what the sick animals are suffering from, but you start to get a sense of what the health of the population is at large.
And we're talking about the encroaching habitat of these seals and sea lions, but there are native peoples in the Arctic region where they have encroaching habitat issues as well. What kind of impact is hunting having on these populations? Is the Marine Mammal Protection Act doing its job? And are we still allowing these indigenous people to still hunt at a reasonable level to keep that connection to these populations in that way?
Yeah, the Marine Mammal Protection Act is doing its job. There are, however, exemptions and allowances for the take by native peoples, indigenous peoples, of some limited marine mammals. There is also, it's an interesting relationship we have as a society with marine mammals, and it varies depending on where you might be. If you think about the coastline north of where we are along the Oregon and Washington coastline, the challenges that are seen there with, again, California sea lions and folks who are involved in the salmon fishery is one that's that is fraught with conflict. And there are and have been allowances for the take, either the translocation or the killing of sea lions. So the same act that ultimately stands up an organization like ours and authorizes us to do the work that we do around rescue is sometimes faced with challenges of one species needs versus another, in that case the salmon versus sea lions. There are also differing philosophies among stranding network members as to what would trigger the rescue of an animal. And for some, it is the very obvious human impact, an injury caused by humans, an entanglement in marine debris, et cetera. And if it appears to be an infectious disease or a shark attack or something of that nature, they will not respond. We've elected to not go through that calculus and basically just respond to animals that need help. And once we bring them in, do our best to recover them and not force ourselves into some decision-making matrix about what the cause of the problem was.
He's the executive director of the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito, California, Jeff Bohm. Jeff, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Red Garland, Crosby, Stills & Nash, and Elton John. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.